DW Deutsche Welle. World in progress.
Yogi Modi Jindabad!
Jindabad!
Jindabad! Modi Yogi Jindabad!
Elections in India, and the BJP party hopes to win it despite the cash crisis that's brought millions to the brink of ruin. What the World Government Summit in Dubai is all about, and standing up for the peace process in Colombia, despite attacks on land rights activists.
I say they've taken so much from us that they took away fear as well. My desire to beat these political mafias grows every day. It's better to live and die for something than for nothing.
All this coming up in this edition. Stay tuned. Welcome to World in Progress with me, Anke Rasper, in Bonn, Germany. In India, parliamentary elections have kicked off in five key states this month, and many see this poll as a referendum on Prime Minister Narendra Modi's controversial demonetization policy. 4 months ago, all 500 and 1,000 rupee bills, almost 86% of cash in circulation in the Indian economy, ceased to be legal tender. The objective behind this huge exercise was to combat tax cheating, illegal cash flows and corruption. But critics say that the move was not prepared well, and its implementation has hit India's rural poor who have little access to banks and financial institutions, as DW correspondent Murali Krishnan reports.
It is election time in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh. The usual razzmatazz associated with a noisy Indian election is, however, strangely missing. The posters, the loud campaigns, and cavalcade of cars are absent. Predictably enough, demonetization has overshadowed all other issues that have caught the attention of people in the current round of assembly elections underway in Goa, Uttarakhand, Punjab, Manipur, and the northern state of Uttar Pradesh. The last being a political bellwether state and will be of most importance for the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party or BJP. Anil Singh, a candidate from the regional Bahujan Samaj Party, explains the lack of enthusiasm about the elections.
There has been a major impact in the overall situation. The government planned this move very badly and there was no preparation. Millions were put into hardship, and that's why demonetization has become a major issue.
Opposition parties are making capital of this unpopular decision by the ruling BJP party, harping on rural distress, where thousands of laborers, artisans, and weavers have lost their jobs. In pockets of Punjab and Uttar Pradesh, farmers are finding it difficult to buy pesticides for the winter crops or have had to hive off their meager land holdings. In towns of western Uttar Pradesh, where economies are sustained mostly by wholesale and retail trading, demonetization has been a killer. In the absence of large industries at these places, trading in food, agro products, industrial goods and crafts are major economic contributors and provide incomes for hundreds of thousands of people who are now facing hard times. Syed Zaman is also a candidate in the election.
It has been more than 100 days since the demonetization drive, and the situation is far from normal. Everyone has been hit, the poor and even the middle class.
The Indian economy's high reliance on cash has only added to the crisis. Many people lack proper access to banks and financial services, so they can't do their transactions by banking or credit cards. Meher Lal is a farmer who had to sell off his land in Muzaffarnagar last month.
My children are dying. What black money are you talking of? I can't pay my rent. It's a big loss for the poor people. The rich will survive, but we have taken the hit.
The biggest mission of demonetization is described as fighting black money. India's economy historically holds a big parallel economy where unreported income is the norm. Mohammed Muzamil, who runs an auto spare parts shop, says his business has taken a huge blow.
Demonetization has really hit us badly. I used to make 2,000 rupees every day, but now I make 100 rupees and sometimes even less. I'm constantly borrowing money. I have nothing.
Since the announcement of demonetization, the income of informal sector workers has come down drastically by up to 60%. Day laborers get less work every day, and that is hurting all the more as many are indebted with their patrons. With the dwindling number of customers and work, people's resources are shrinking. The transactions of the poor with financial intermediaries, whether money lenders or microfinance institutions, have come to a standstill. So has the move backfired? The BJP national president, Amit Shah, does not seem to think so.
Jail rules apply equally to all. If they, the political parties, have no money, then we too have no money. The idea is to weed out black money from the system. It is not as if we're not affected, but this will create a level playing field.
Economic analyst M.K. Venu, who's been closely watching the demonetization drive, thinks otherwise.
The people who've really got hit, several million jobs have been lost in the unorganized sector, in construction sector, farmers have lost incomes. When they go to vote, they will definitely be angry. It will be a negative vote for BJP.
The BJP says the primary motive behind the move was to eliminate black money or illegal sources of income that has been fundamental, especially for political parties, to fund their election campaigns and garner votes over the years. The demonetization move was carefully timed just before the assembly elections. S.Y. Qureshi, the former Chief Election Commissioner of India, believes elections in the country should be state-funded. But political parties have not supported this change so far.
The fact that state funding has been talked about for years, for two, three, four decades at the political level, there have been parliamentary committees on it. The purpose being the concern that the money is playing havoc with the political system and needs to be checked, provided the political parties have internal democracy, which doesn't seem to be happening. So we are where we were three decades ago.
The election in Uttar Pradesh, or UP, is crucial for Modi, given its enormous significance in Indian politics. UP is the most populous state in the country, with over 200 million inhabitants. It elects the highest number of lawmakers to both houses of Indian Parliament. But it won't be an easy ride for the BJP in the state-level polls this time around. The electoral alliance between the regional Samajwadi Party and the Congress Party has given a boost to BJP's opposition. In Punjab, the chances of the Aam Aadmi Party or Common Man's Party, a group campaigning against corruption, securing victory are pretty sound. Polls indicate that the party, which has a government in Delhi, could win the Punjab state election. Giles Vernier, who teaches political science and is a close observer of politics in Uttar Pradesh, has an interesting take.
I think initially there was enthusiasm for the measure. I think the idea that the Prime Minister would go after the rich, the wealthy and the corrupt was and still is in many ways a very popular measure. But now that the consequences are unfolding and there are definitely delayed effects that some of them are starting to be felt right now, people are starting to see it differently.
If the BJP fares well in this crucial round of assembly polls, it would be an acknowledgement of Modi's policies and his endeavour to make India corruption-free. A defeat could force the party to get back to the drawing board. Results will be counted on March 11. For DW, I'm Murli Krishnan in Muzaffarnagar, Uttar Pradesh.
We're moving to Dubai in the United Arab Emirates next, where this week the 5th annual World Government Summit took place. It's a massive international conference, though not very well known in the West. There were delegations from more than 130 countries among the 4,000 participants and lots of big names among the speakers, including IMF head Christine Lagarde, Tesla CEO Elon Musk, numerous economists and scientists, as well as politicians. Two DW reporters, Pavlos Zafiropoulos and Myrto Papadopoulos, attended the summit. I caught up with Pavlos on the last day of the meeting. and first asked him, since this was the first major international conference since the inauguration of Donald Trump as US president, how much of a role that played at the Dubai summit.
It's definitely made it more interesting, I think. The dramatic change, especially in the political direction that the United States is taking, I think is definitely on people's minds. At the same time, I would say it's not something that people are frightened about here. It almost seems that they look at it with an air of detached bemusement. And the whole summit is very forward-thinking. It's very much looking towards solutions, modern and very innovative solutions, both in terms of governance and in terms of technology, energy. It's almost through the looking glass, because here we are in a Middle Eastern country and they seem more forward-thinking and more optimistic at the same time when both in Europe and in the United States with the recent political changes, things seem much more inward-looking.
Climate change is also a big focus there at the conference. Is that surprising to you? After all, I mean, Dubai is part of the United Arab Emirates and oil and gas exports are really important for the economy there.
I'd say I've been quite surprised how seriously they seem to be taking it. The government of Dubai actually has a minister for climate change. It's something that they're taking very seriously, both in terms of the threat it poses for the United Arab Emirates and for Dubai, and also the kinds of solutions that they can pioneer to actually turn this challenge into an opportunity. And I actually got an opportunity to sit down with Jeffrey Sachs, who has been working on the issues of sustainability for many years, and I asked him to give his opinion on this.
I think one of the most important questions facing countries in the Gulf region is the future of an energy system that needs to move to a zero carbon base. We know that to achieve the Paris Climate Agreement will require what we call deep decarbonization, in other words, going from coal, oil, and gas to going to renewable energy sources. And I think countries in this region are realizing that that's a strategic issue for them. After all, the fall of oil prices now looks to be systemic, not just cyclical.
Yeah, and another thing that surprised me is that effectively the United States administration has very strongly signaled that they don't believe in climate change and so they should do nothing. The general sense was, you know, even if they're not going to come with us, we're moving ahead because we have to, because this is something that is an existential threat to our country. That is something that I heard from a number of people. One very telling moment of this was in a question and answer session with the economist Joseph Stiglitz. He was actually asked, should the international community consider the possibility of putting sanctions on the United States and the United States companies that flout the Paris Agreement if the United States does eventually pull out of this? That's kind of where the conversation is that we're moving ahead and what can we do about this big giant who may not be coming along with us?
So apart from climate change, radicalization was also high on the agenda, I take it.
Yes, I think it's always high on the agenda in any country in the Middle East. Fortunately for the United Arab Emirates, it's not a problem that they have directly had to deal with in the sense that there haven't been any major terrorist attacks here. But it's definitely something that they're fearful of. And the phenomena of radicalization is something that they do not want to see happening in their own country. And they're looking for any way that they can make sure that that doesn't happen. And one speaker here is a researcher about these facts. He's been researching it for a long time, is Ari Kuglensky. And this is what he told me.
United Arab Emirates, among other nations, radicalization these days is a problem that is a top item of most governments' agenda around the globe. As we are witnessing these days, the most extensive, the most dangerous wave of violent extremism in the history of mankind. And if you couple it with technologies, with possibilities of movement, possibility of transportation, the danger is indeed immense of disrupting the world order. That's why I'm here. That's why my colleagues who study this topic are here. We need to understand that xenophobia and erecting boundaries is only going to intensify the problem.
Pavlos, you said just before that there are open discussions happening. Now I wonder, given the political background where it's taking place, how much of a critical discussion is actually possible in Dubai?
It's a good question, given that it isn't a democracy in this country. It's effectively a monarchic system. So they don't have democratic traditions that we're used to questioning authority, to having different political parties. So how do they talk about governance, if this is the case? And I found one, there are these books that are being given out all throughout the conference, and it's been written by Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, who is the prime minister and ruler of Dubai. He says, "I would like to point out that when we talk about the government of the future, we focus on the delivery of services and not on political structures. Different countries have diverse forms of government. However, they all work towards one goal, serving citizens." They're not talking about different forms of political structures. What they are talking about in terms of governments is how governments can execute their function. That's what they're interested. On that level, though, they are actually very interested in different solutions on how you measure the success rate, the effectiveness of a government, how you make it more efficient, more adaptable. And then there is a lot of innovation, and I think there is an honest dialogue that goes on around that. They're not going to question who's in charge, but they will question how that person who is in charge can best serve their function.
What's the main thing you take home from this Dubai World Government Summit? Is it just a talking shop, or does it really make a difference?
Well, at a time when there are a lot of questions that have been raised about globalization in the West, I would say that one thing that I take away from this summit is that in other places, globalization is alive and well. Definitely Dubai is a city that has been built around globalization, and it is definitely, from the rulers to everyone else I met, they seem very open towards globalization, is that is the way for the future for them. I would say that the West has also become quite inward-looking and quite concerned about these problems and looking to the past. Whereas here, I think that still it's a very optimistic attitude, is that people, they're very much aware of the challenges like climate change, like radicalization, but they're very open and very optimistic that new innovations, both in technology and social innovations, will help them deal with it. And let's not forget, Dubai has also announced that they're announcing a Mars mission. It's very easy to get carried away with all this optimism. At the same time, the summit is very Dubai, and Dubai is an impressive city in the sense that from 40 years in what was effectively a collection of small buildings and a lot of tents and dirt roads has turned into this almost science fiction looking city on the desert. That rapid growth is both impressive, but it also leads you to wonder how sustainable it is. Are the foundations solid? And I think that's something that only time will tell.
That was Pavlos Zafiropoulos talking about this week's World Government Summit in Dubai. After half a century of war, peace in Colombia remains very shaky. Despite the peace deal with the FARC, the country's largest rebel group, the government has just started peace talks with another militia group, the ELN, but a series of assassinations is threatening progress. Just last weekend, another human rights activist was killed by paramilitaries. In January alone, 17 left-wing activists, land rights advocates, and local community leaders, all supporters of the peace process, were assassinated in rural areas of the country. Many others face intimidation and threats. Many of these assassinations take place in areas the FARC is leaving, as neo-paramilitary groups move in to assert their control over drug trafficking, gold and water rights. Luis Gaggio reports from the Antioquia province of Colombia.
I meet Leon Freddy Muñoz in a busy cafe in Bello, a town about an hour's drive north of Medellin. Medellin is the capital of Antioquia, Colombia's most populous province and center stage of the country's armed conflict. Leon Freddy Muñoz is a casual guy in his late 40s, not somebody you'd think he'll be surrounded by three bodyguards who keep a close watch as he orders his cup of coffee. He's a human rights defender, and in Colombia, that's one of the most dangerous jobs a person could have. He survived 6 assassination attempts, the last one just 5 months ago.
Things are very clear here. There is an extreme right-wing force that wants to destabilize this peace process.
Leon Freddy is also the director of an NGO that partners with rural community organizations in Antioquia to promote strategies that push for the full implementation of the peace agreement. 3 people from his organization were gunned down last month, and 25 others have received death threats. Lunfredi tells me he's especially worried about the fact that when the peace deal was reached, the government agreed to designate 14 seats in Congress for rural leaders from areas previously controlled by the FARC. These are areas where the FARC have begun demobilizing. The current killings are happening exactly in these regions. To Lunfredi, it's clear that those behind the killings are carrying out a violent campaign to prevent community leaders, human rights defenders, and left-wing activists from making it into public office.
I think that the peace process is being put at risk, and we're seeing paramilitary groups fill the void FARC is leaving, and they're filling it with blood and bullets. So what are people left to do? We're getting information that farmers are thinking of arming themselves in the Urabá region to defend their lives.
Urabá, the region in Antioquia Lunfredi is talking about, is located in northwestern Colombia, tucked away between the Caribbean coast and the dense forest that borders Panama. It has long been an area disputed by guerrilla and paramilitary groups who want to control drug trafficking and illegal gold mining. Back in Medellin, I meet up with Eduardo. He's a farmer and community leader who fled the Urabá region just a few days ago after one of his colleagues, José Cartagena, was killed there. They were both active in an organization advocating for land reform. Cartagena was his vice president before a paramilitary group abducted, tortured, and killed them.
Estando ahí cuando sucedió la muerte de un dirigente.
While I was there, I received the news of the death of the leader in our farmers' association. They killed him, and I got very scared. I called a friend, and they knew that I was second on the list.
José Cartagena was 30 years old, and his body was found a few miles away from one of the 26 United Nations camps where the FARC are set to disarm. Eduardo is in his 60s. He rushed to sell his business back in Urabá. He only got about half the price it is worth, but he and his wife had to leave quickly.
I felt really bad about how easy it is for these people to act and be accomplices of the state and the level of impunity. That really frightened me. That's why I'm here in Medellin, very afraid because I know they have many tentacles.
The Colombian government refuses to admit that these killings are systematic, and even that there are paramilitary groups currently operating in the country. Many of the paramilitary groups were formed in the 1980s with the support of the state and the armed forces to help wealthy landowners fight groups like the FARC. The largest paramilitary group started in Antioquia and, fueled by drug trafficking money, expanded to the rest of the country. In 2005, it demobilized in a controversial peace deal. However, many of the 30,000 fighters refused to lay down their weapons. Instead, they regrouped and now continue to operate illegally, controlling drug trafficking and illegal schemes across the country. The government refers to them as criminal gangs, not paramilitary groups, and categorizes the assassinations committed by these groups as isolated cases. However, the human rights group Somos Defensores says more than 80 community leaders were killed by these new paramilitary groups in 2016 alone. The numbers for 2017 are already looking much worse.
To say that these killings are not systematic is to say that they're political, which is even more worrying.
That's Clara Navarro, who works for an NGO that is currently offering assistance and protection to Eduardo and his wife.
Neo-paramilitarism. The community leaders start to pose a huge problem for these neo-paramilitary groups. And we define them as neo-paramilitary because they're a direct product of those paramilitary groups that existed in Colombia and continue to operate with the same objectives.
Clara explains that rural community leaders represent a threat to the neo-paramilitary groups because, under the peace process, displaced farmers will be given back the land they were forced to leave by the conflict. As the neo-paramilitary groups fill in the void left by the FARC in these territories, they would silence and attempt to kill anyone who gets in their way. That's because the land is rich in natural resources, and those controlling it can continue to profit from the drug trade, illegal mining, and extortion.
¿Qué está en juego, la paz? Claro, pues es evidente que está.
Peace is what's at stake here. There's a thin line between war and peace, because I feel there's a fragility in the peace accord due to the killings of our rural leaders, who are a big obstacle to the elites who now own the land. And you know, people can make a lot of money in times of war and conflict.
En la guerra todo el mundo se beneficia y la guerra produce mucho billete.
Clara takes me to San Carlos, about 4 hours east of Medellin. A decade ago, this small town, population of 20,000, was ravaged by the violence from paramilitary groups. More than 1,500 residents were killed and hundreds disappeared. Most people fled and slowly returned to San Carlos after several years away. Today is a relatively peaceful place, but the wounds run deep and the collective trauma is felt by its residents. Ángela Moreno's four brothers were killed by the paramilitaries, but she returned. I meet her outside of her colorful home. The single mother is calm, and she talks about the challenges facing human rights activists like her, who are active in the movement to preserve people's land and water rights.
San Carlos is a paraíso. Contamos con una riqueza hídrica.
San Carlos is a paradise in terms of water resources, and it's the focus of many interests. Its wealth has made it attractive and caused this armed conflict, because the dispute has not been between communities, but rather for land.
Disputa no es entre comunidades, sino disputas por territorios.
Paramilitary groups used barbaric methods to drive people off their land. As the violence escalated and more people were forced to leave, four hydroelectric power plants were built near the town. Because of the ongoing violence, there was little protest against the projects.
Es un territorio que está bajo intereses.
This region is very interesting to a number of players, and many lives have been sacrificed on behalf of these strong interests.
Se tenga que sacrificar las vidas de un montón de personas.
That's Daisy Herrera, a 46-year-old environmental engineer who's also an activist for water and land rights in the region.
The number one problem for these hydroelectric projects has been what to do with the people who live and own this land. From 1995 until 2006, we saw a violent outburst by paramilitary groups against the people to displace them from their own land.
And these methods of violence were terrifying.
They used a horrible tactic. They would open the farmers' bodies up with a chainsaw, fill them with stones, and then dump them in the river.
Activists like Daisy Herrera and Ángela Moreno, who have both been threatened recently by paramilitary groups, now fear that such horrific acts of violence could return to the region. They say illegal groups are increasingly shifting their business interests from drug trafficking to control over resources like water or gold mines.
In Colombia, we have the curse of being rich in natural resources, and the interest to control them has resulted in violence, displacement, and blood.
Violencia, sangre y muerte.
In Medellín, I meet with the chief peace advisor to the governor of Antioquia, Luis Guillermo Pardo. He agrees that the situation is troubling and that the government needs to act fast to secure territories previously controlled by the FARC and protect community leaders and activists.
Es que el Estado debe darle prioridad.
The state should give priority to the defense of these community leaders and design security schemes to guarantee their ability to do their social and community work without being threatened. That's a challenge the government has, as well as society and the international community.
But there's little hope that things will improve quickly. The government lacks the resources to assign bodyguards to everyone who's been threatened. There are no exact figures, but estimates put the current number of illegal paramilitary groups at 6,000 members. While the peace accord with the FARC has brought a lot of hope, and new negotiations have started with another guerrilla group, many in Colombia are starting to lose faith that lasting peace can be achieved in the near future. Back in the cafe in Bello, I ask Leonfredi, the human rights activist and NGO leader, whether he's afraid he might die in another assassination attempt. He says he worries about his two sons the most. He can't see them very often now.
I say they've taken so much from us that they took away fear as well. My desire to beat these political mafias grows every day. I have my security team and take the necessary precautions. But I think it's better to live and die for something than for nothing.
For DW, I'm Luis Gallo in Antioquia, Colombia.
And that report by Luis Gaggio wraps up this edition of World in Progress. Thanks for joining me today. If you'd like to listen to this or past episodes again, just go to dw.com/worldinprogress or find us on iTunes or SoundCloud. Thanks very much for tuning in from all of us in the studio here in Bonn, Germany, Eliane Giaducci and Johannes Schmühling. I'm Anke Raspa, and this was World in Progress. Take care.